Well, good afternoon and welcome to the fourth and last class in this series of four classes on restoration history. Yesterday we began with Dr. Loretta Honeycutt. She teaches history at Pepperdine, and she gave the presentation on Selina Campbell, the wife of Alexander Campbell. That was fascinating. Selina lived from 1802 to 1897. She really filled out the 19th century, and she outlived Alexander by 31 years.
Wow.
So she was quite the leader, and that was a fascinating lecture. Then our second lecture was by Bonnie Miller, who's with us today. She's a BA, MA graduate of Pepperdine, and she wrote a book called Messengers of the Risen Sun in the Land of the Rising Sun, which were all the single women. Come on in, Glenn. We'll just let people stand. The single women who went to Japan in beginning in about 1882, and she stopped at about 1950. She yesterday did Sarah Andrews, who went in 1915, died in 1961, gave her entire life to Japan, established four congregations that had amazing staying power even after World War II. I remember when she died because I was in high school in Canada at a Christian high school, and I remember our principal coming into chapel and saying, "We have just received news that Sarah Andrews, a legendary missionary in Japan, has died, and we feel that you students should know who she is and what she has accomplished." And this was new to me. I was 16 or 17 in high school hearing about Sarah Andrews. So those were the two yesterday. Now we've just finished class three, which was John Wilson describing the beginnings of campus ministry in Churches of Christ. He went back to 1959 when he started, when he was there, described the situation in 59 all through the 60s into the beginning of the 70s, then came to where we are now and looked backward and made some observations. Now, you've already seen the title for this class. This one is on Michael Faraday, the famous scientist in 19th century England. I think I pulled it out of a poem. I think I called the title, if you got your booklet in front of you, Great Faraday Who Made the World So Wise. Is that it? That's from Cosmo Monkwell. I love that poem. Great Faraday Who Made the World So Wise.
Jerry, did you push the button to record?
I think I did.
Okay, just want to make sure.
Bonnie's going on my hymns tour on Sunday. And her main job is to keep me on track and turning on recorders. So she's practicing today. But I've got it all on. Hi, Yuki. Good to have you. Okay, everything I've said to this point is preliminary. So are we ready to begin?
Yes.
I remember where I was. I was on Old Brompton Road. I had come from South Kim Tube Station. I was walking toward Queensgate. It was on the right side of the street. Lori and I were serving as faculty parents in Pepperdine's Year in Europe program. It was November of 1999. To remind you, it was only 6 weeks before the end of the second millennium, and only 6 weeks before the beginning of the third millennium. And the papers were full of articles about the coming of the third millennium, and reflections every day in the London papers, reflections on the 1,000 years that were just now ending. And we could count every few days on articles on the 100 greatest poets of the second millennium, the 100 greatest inventors of the second millennium, the 100 greatest athletes, the 100 greatest explorers. All of these categories for the greatest people in the second millennium. I knew who the greatest person was in the second millennium. It was the risen Christ, but I knew they weren't going to give us the risen Christ. I knew who the greatest personage was in the first millennium because it was dated from his birth, but they weren't going to give us the risen Christ. So I wasn't prepared. You know, I wasn't going to argue with that. But all these lists were coming out. But we were waiting for one list that had a blue ribbon committee of people from 40 nations or something, and they had been working for months to decide who was number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Who were the 100 most significant people in the entire second millennium from 1,000 to 2,000? I was walking down the street. It was lunchtime. Up on the right-hand side was a Burger King, small little restaurant. It's not there now. I moved away. I guess that's why they... I went in there to the Burger King, got my hamburger and Coke, fries, sat down to read, had my daily paper, the London Telegraph, opened up. Here it was toward the end of November, 1999, and there it was. The article I had been waiting for on the 100 most significant people of the second millennium. And I took a deep breath, settled in, opened the paper. Number one was Gutenberg. I could live with that. The invention of printing. The first printing of the Bible. Yes, Gutenberg. As a person who loves books, who loves the smell of libraries, who will go into a library just to smell it, and who people come to my home comment on my own library. I could live with Gutenberg, number one. If it can't be the risen Christ, I'll be comfortable with Gutenberg. I think number two is Galileo. We need to know where we are in the universe and where, what our spot is and what's revolving around what. That's pretty crucial. I think third place was either Leonardo da Vinci or maybe Isaac Newton, gravity. But what absolutely stunned me and almost knocked me off my chair was number six. It was Michael Faraday. And I remember in my chair scooting backward like, Faraday! Because I went back 10 years to 1989, Volume 31, number 4, last issue of the year, the Restoration Quarterly, lead article, Brother Faraday, by Herbert Pratt from Newcastle, Delaware. That article stunned me. I hadn't heard of Faraday. I'm not interested in science. I'm a humanities guy. I get bored with science. But here he was talking about Faraday, and he calls the article Brother Faraday because they sistered and brothered everybody in the 19th century. Brother Faraday, this great article about his role as an elder in the Church of Christ. I read it. I was touched by it. I forgot it for 10 years. And now I'm sitting in the Burger King on Old Brompton Road, and Faraday is number six. This is amazing to me. And I want to tell you something about this group that he comes out of. Michael Faraday, a chapter in British history. If you teach a class on the history of the Churches of Christ in the UK, which I've done now four times in London, here's how I outline it. I'll begin by saying not everybody agrees with this, but I'll defend it. I think I'm right. I start with the old Tottlebank Church of Christ and the seven congregations around it in that little thumb of land down by Barrow, but just below the Lake District, that began in the reign of Charles II. The record book we still have, it's in an Oxford college library, that opens with the Church of Christ at Tottlebank began on August 18th in the year 1669 in the reign of Charles II. Some people said to me, no, you got it wrong, Jerry, because seven of those eight congregations eventually affiliated with the Baptist movement. The Baptist movement was larger. It was more vibrant. We have a lot in common with the Baptists. The movements were very similar. And seven of the eight, including Tottlebank. The old Tottlebank building that's there now was built in 1703, even though the congregation started in 1669. 1703. I preached there in 2003 at the tricentennial. I know those people. They know me. They trust me. I preach there. They let me use their communion ware when I come through and I'm meeting someplace else. It's a great church. But even though seven of those eight ended up in the Baptist movement, one said no. No, we're comfortable being a Church of Christ. And they disappeared from history, but they were still over there, 5 miles from Tottlebank in the little town of Kirby. Spelled K-I-R-K-B-Y, Kirby Inverness. How small is that? The road leading in is one lane. The road leading out is one lane. I'll be preaching for that church in 9 days. And when my executive motor coach comes into that town, we have to hope nobody else is coming from the other direction because we dominate that one lane. One side of our coach almost hitting this house, the other coach almost hitting this house. We're on our way to the Wall End Church of Christ. And the cemetery at Wall End, where William Robinson is buried, and some of the great 19th century evangelists in the Restoration Movement. It is a sacred place. I was there 13 months ago. I preach every time I go. 13 months ago, John Wilson gave the communion meditation, and Bill Adrian, our former provost, gave one of the prayers, and Susan Gibney gave one of the readings, and Bonnie Miller gave one of the readings. And we go in with our congregation of 37, and John Free was at the back filming, weren't you? John was getting a little video back there for us. We will be there in 9 days. So there was one congregation that said, no, we're going to stay Church Christ. We've got their record books in 1824. They thought they were the only Church Christ on planet Earth in 1824. George Barr says so. How did they find out about the rest of us? 1855, a preacher from the Campbell movement, Francis Hill, wandered into that little town, met them, watched them worship, ate with them, and said, you're not the only Church of Christ in England. There's about 80 here. You need to look up, be aware of what you're a part of. And then they became a part. The building where I will preach next week, it says on the front, built 1876. Built of native limestone. Gorgeous building. So I think we're right to say we start with Tottlebank. Number two, John Glass, Robert Sandeman. Glass broke from the Church of Scotland. They kicked him out of the Church of Scotland. He didn't think it was biblical enough. He persuaded his little congregation in Teeling, Scotland, T-E-A-L-I-N-G. I drove through Teeling one time just to see this historic spot, and I was all the way through the town before I'd realized I had driven through it. And I turned around and drove back just to say I had been at Teeling. But 100 of his church members stayed with him and accepted being kicked out of the Church of Scotland to stay closer to the Bible. But he built his biggest church in Dundee, just a few miles from Teeling. John Glass never had a big movement. But he called his churches Churches of Christ. And his daughter, Catherine, fell in love with a man at the University of Edinburgh, and she married him, Robert Sandeman. And Sandeman became the great leader. It was not only a Glassite Church of Christ, but in the southern part of England, in London, it was called the Sandemanian Church of Christ. More about them in a minute. The third were the Scotch Baptists, who pulled off from Glass Sandeman, because Glass Sandeman never quite moved up to adult baptism. They were still pedo-baptists. They baptized children, although adults who came into their fellowship and wanted to be baptized could be immersed. Some were. Most were poured. So the Glass-Sandeman movement, even though they restored weekly celebration of the Lord's Supper and the autonomy of each church and called themselves Churches of Christ and all this, they still were not as similar in baptism as the Scotch Baptists became, who pulled off. Because they sent one of their preachers down to London to look at the Barbican Baptist Church. And John Gill, the great forerunner to Charles Spurgeon, and Gill baptized this man in the baptistry at the Barbican Church. And then he came back up to Edinburgh and baptized several others. And that was the beginning of the Scotch Baptist movement. They had a great historian, William Jones. I've got several William Jones books in my library. He wrote the history of the Albigenses and the history of the Waldenses. And he's a great historian. He's buried at Bunhill Fields, where we're going to be next week on Wednesday, singing around the grave of Isaac Watts. He's there, William Jones. And it was his church, which is right behind where John Wesley is buried across the street. The old church that was there is where the young man came from Bethany, Virginia, and worshiped with him in 1832 and said, this is just like my church back home. And William Jones said, what's your church back home? Well, it's the Bethany Church of Christ. Who's your preacher? Well, his name is Alexander Campbell. And William Jones said, not the Alexander Campbell that 4 years ago debated Robert Owen in Cincinnati. Yes, that's him. That's my man, Alex. And so that was the beginning of the correspondence. Saul and the Millennial Harbinger. I couldn't make this up for anything. All the letters are there between William Jones and Alexander Campbell starting in 1833, 1834. So this is the Scotch Baptist movement, getting to know the Campbell movement. In fact, all of our early members in the UK were from the Scotch Baptist movement. Come to think of it, all of them in Ontario, where I went to high school, all those early churches where I started preaching at 16 in Ontario, these were all from the Scotch Baptist movement who migrated to Canada and became a part of the Campbellstone movement. And then number four, the Haldane movement, the James and Robert Alexander, the two brothers up in the central Scotland. They finally confront baptism in 1808. They begin immersing in 1808. So these movements have a lot in common. And finally, the Campbell movement, sort of Johnny come lately, maybe 1804, 1807. And as late as the 1830s, somebody who's a great leader in the Churches of Christ thinks that there are only three congregations that he knows of. And there's the one where mom and dad are at, the one where he and his wife is at, and one in Chester in between. That's about it. We're going to be singing in those homes next week. There are two of those houses where the Church of Christ met are still standing in the little village of Mollington. So here's the five. When you're teaching the class, that's the outline I would... Oops. Now what did I do there?
Something.
Well, you got... Oh. They won't do it. You got to...
How do I get a full
screen?
Screen
down there.
Anybody know how to get a full screen?
Yep.
Oh, sorry about that.
There you go.
There you go.
You want to go back one?
Yeah, I got to go back one. This is John Glass's marker. I was just going to show you. It's very hard to read. He's buried in Dundee. His character in the Churches of Christ is well known and will outlive all monumental inscriptions. That's John Glass. And this is his son-in-law, Sandeman. Sandeman starts and preaches for the Church of Christ in London, which is what we're about this morning, where Faraday's going to be an elder. But he ends up going to America and establishing what he calls, quote, the first Church of Christ in North America. In Danbury, Connecticut. And he dies there 6 years later in 1761. And on his marker, it says that he boldly contended for the ancient faith and the bare work of Jesus Christ without a deed or thought on the part of man is sufficient to present the chief of sinners spotless before God to declare the blessed truth and so on. Tom Albright told me where I could find this. And I went back with my oldest daughter, Hillary, and I said, let's divide up. And she got this into the cemetery, and I got that one down there, and we're going. And then I can still hear her voice, Daddy, he's over here! And I started running. I had my jacket on, and my jacket was flapping. And I am dodging tombstones and running, you know, like just down a football field, just tiptoeing through. And I didn't realize she had her iPhone on, and she's just capturing all of it. And she showed me these pictures afterward, and I said, what are you doing? And she said, I'm showing these at your funeral. This is what will capture my father best, running through cemeteries, elated, happy, looking for another historic grave. Well, I was. I wanted to see where Sandeman was at. Now, here's the map of the Glass Sandeman movement. Never very big. Never more than about 14 churches at one time. In fact, when Faraday was an elder, there was only six churches in Scotland and six in England in that famous census of 1851 that England took of all the churches. So it's never a very big movement. And yet, for Faraday, he's a member here at London. But he preaches at Old Buckingham, he preaches at Trobed, he goes to Swansea, the only one in Wales, but he goes back home and preaches at Dundee and at Edinburgh. Now here's the old church at Dundee. Here's the sign right here that says Glassite Church. This was the extent of the church right here. On August 9 of 1862, Faraday preached here. He was in his 72nd year. And the place was packed because it was Faraday. And he preached from John 11, 25 and 26, where Jesus said, you know, to Martha there at the tomb of Lazarus, I am the resurrection. You're talking about I am the resurrection and the life. You know, that was his text. And an elder who was there, I saw it in a letter, wrote that his face shone like the face of an angel. Faraday preaching in his 72nd year here at the old Church of Christ in Dundee. And here's the Church of Christ in Edinburgh. And we will be here early on Wednesday morning, May the 20th, in less than 2 weeks. and we will arrive right at 8:45, and we will go in and take our pictures in front of the old Church of Christ sign, which has been brought in from outside to save it from the weather. The congregation established there in 1835, and we'll go on inside the building into the area where we're going to sing, and all the song leaders will come up here. John Euled from here, and when they have this overhang so that your voice goes up and then bounces out to the car. And these are all box pews, the old box pews where you have to pull the door open to go in, and the big light coming, you know, from above, the old church at, now let's back up and take a look at Faraday. These are some of the churches he preached at. Faraday was born in London. He's born in a city that is the biggest city in the world, the most populous city in the world. King George III is on the throne. William Pitt is the prime minister. I mean, England is the center of everything. And here is this young man who has no formal education, very little. His father is a mechanic. His mother is a country maid. But Faraday is going to end up being the sixth most significant person in the millennium. And he grows up in this tiny little, and his parents are members of this little Sandemanian Church of Christ, they called it, in London. And Michael is going to eventually be an elder there. And he's going to marry a young girl from that congregation whose father is one of the elders. So here's Faraday, and he marries Sarah, and her father is an elder. When they married, Sarah was 20 and he was 29. He's 9 years older, but she looks considerably older. I mean, he's a very youthful-looking man, and Sarah doesn't photograph as well. They moved into this. This is the Royal Institution on Albemarle Street, number 21. And they took up residence on the top floor and lived there for 40 years. Wow. And he would not, even though he had money, and more so as he got more famous, he would never take a horse-drawn carriage to church. He thought it was putting on airs. Lori and I walked from here to where that Church of Christ is. And I mean, we power walked, and we were moving up and down those curbs and parting the crowds. And it was 30 minutes, and we were sweating. And I know he didn't do it in 30 minutes. So they started out at 10. Church started at 11. They had their worship, then they had their love feast. The room is still up there where we had the love feast. I'm just curious, how many of you have been with me to that church? Anybody in this room? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, I thought some had. There's the love feast up in the top, and then they would have their second worship in the afternoon, and only as the conclusion to the day would they begin to prepare for the Lord's Supper at 4 o'clock, which would end at 5 o'clock, and then the hour walk home. So it's about 10 in the morning to about 6 every single Sunday. One thing about the Sandemanians is that missing church was not acceptable. That was means of disfellowship. You never, ever, ever missed. And the same was true on Wednesday night. So they repeated this on Wednesday night. And it was a long walk, but it was the center of their life. And this was the center of scientific London. So here's Faraday, photographed early on. At the peak of his powers, and a woman came up one time and sketched his little area where he did his research. It's still there. The most exciting museum in London is the Faraday Museum, and I've been to all of them. I mean, the City of London Museum is great. Of course, the British Museum is outstanding, but this is something to go to the Faraday Museum. Now, I have to talk about something that happened in England in 1970. I went there for the first time in 71. Starting in 1970, the English people said, okay, we always have the Queen or the King on our currency. We don't need to bump them off. But on the other side, couldn't we put some of our great people, the English people, I mean, we are a great people. So they started thinking, who could they put on currency? And I was going to tell you, on the £1 note, we don't have £1 notes anymore. We have pound pieces, right? But on the £1 note, it was Isaac Newton. Who could quarrel with that? On the £5 note, the Duke of Wellington, this will all be on the final exam in just a moment, the Duke of Wellington, who defeats Napoleon at Waterloo in 1815. Then on the £10 note, Florence Nightingale. On the £20 note, it was William Shakespeare, of course. And on the £50 note, it was Sir Christopher Wren, the architect of St. Paul. Nobody had a problem with that. But then you're only supposed to be on for 10 years. You know, Florence Nightingale gracefully moved over so that Charles Dickens could be on the 10-pound note. And I forget who replaced all the others. But when Shakespeare finished his first 10 years, which would have been 1980, because I went over there in 71, I got my 20-pound note with Shakespeare. I thought, that was cool. I was over there in 80. Shakespeare was still hanging strong on the 20. He was still hanging strong in 1990. We're 20 years in now. And they're beginning to have a little discomfort as to who in our history could bump Shakespeare off the 20-pound note. You shouldn't have started with Shakespeare. And there was a little discussion back and forth. And finally, in 1990, I can give you the date, June 5th of 91, out came the 20-pound note with Michael Faraday. But they kept going with Shakespeare. They had two of them going for a while, for about 2 years. So I've kept my Michael Faraday 20-pound note, you know, because he only stayed on for 10 years from 1991 to 2001. But Faraday on... there's a new book out, London Review of Books, and it had this line. I loved it. The serene face of Michael Faraday radiates from all directions. First in disguised profile on a postage stamp, then more handsomely on the 20-pound note, and then illuminating the dark warrens of the London Underground, he now advertises an exhibition at the Science Museum to commemorate the bicentennial of his birth. And visitors to this intimate and thoughtful display are reminded of how much the modern world owes to the gentle giant of experimental science, whose insights into electromagnetism were eventually to find application in motors and machines, which transformed human life even as they transformed electrical currents. And when you walk into the museum, you are reminded right at the beginning what a godly man he was, and how much he loved his Bible. And at the very first point in the exhibition, there is this big inscription from Romans 1:20. George Pepperdine's great verse from the words of Jesus in Matthew 10, "Freely you have received, freely give." For Faraday, it is this one, from Romans 1:20. "For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and divinity, so that human beings are without excuse." This was what drove Faraday on. Well, there he is on the 20-pound note. Here's the famous side of the note that I'm always fascinated by. The man who drew this, Alexander Blakely, was a Sandemanian. He went to church with Faraday. He was a great artist. That'll go off in a moment. On the back side, you know, every note has to have a picture on the back. What was it for Shakespeare? The balcony scene from Romeo and Juliet was on the 20-pound note, right? You were going to get that right anyway. I won't even mark that wrong that you had, that you hesitated. But here's the picture of Blakely on the coin. But this is how he actually painted it with Faraday's left hand. This is the famous Christmas lecture that he gave every year. This is December 27, 1855. And who is out there? Albert, Prince Albert, the husband of Queen Victoria. And who is next to him? You know, the Prince of Wales. He's going to be Edward the whatever in 1901. Edward's going to be the king after Victoria. And here's the second, you know, the heir and the spare. The two boys are there with the daughters. And here's Faraday lecturing in 1855. And the person who does the artwork is a fellow church member from the Sandemanians. That's fascinating. Okay, just a quick word of how far they walked to church. This will interest nobody but me, but bear with me. I love it. Okay, here, down here is, let's see, Blackfriars, and so we've got St. Paul. So here's St. Paul's Cathedral right here to orient you. And straight north of St. Paul's is the British Museum right here. And then up here is a very trendy area. This is the Barbican with their lakes. They have their own theater and their own... If you work in downtown London, the city of London, you want to live at the Barbican. But this was the poorest area in Faraday's day. And the Church of Christ was in Paul's Alley, which was bombed in World War II. I've been looking through old maps forever to figure out where it was. And I finally found it this week. It was actually behind where the British Museum is. It was right about here. See, St. Giles Cathedral is right there. It's still standing. It survived the bombing. That's where John Milton is buried. But you come out in this direction, and right in here was St. Paul's Alley. And all the biographers of Faraday say he went to church every week down a squalid alley. All of them use the word squalid. And it's true, it was just the ugliest part of London, and the church was so inexpensive and cheap. It seated 200, but Faraday was comfortable there. He became an elder there. He preached every other Sunday. His beautiful bass voice, he led singing. He read scripture. And all the people who visited there and made comments said, when the great Faraday was sitting there and a poor illiterate brother was reading scripture, Faraday was leaning forward. He wasn't concerned about the vessel through whom it was coming. He was listening to the word of God. Faraday listening for what God had to say, even from this poor illiterate brother. Faraday didn't feel comfortable a couple of miles away, less than 2 miles, at St. Paul's Cathedral. Those weren't his people. When the Duke of Wellington died, Faraday had a ticket. Everybody in the city would have given him a bundle for that ticket to go to the Duke of Wellington's funeral, but Faraday didn't go. Faraday didn't socialize much, but he and Sarah loved the opera. They went to the opera a lot. He never missed the circus when it came to town. He loved the zoo. They loved to go on walks. They walked everywhere. They were in good shape. But they didn't socialize much. Everybody wanted to come and see Faraday. And he was always kind when people did. But he didn't socialize much. But now, follow me from way up here where the old Church of Christ was. I'd love to know what route they walked. But through this warren of streets, and you're finally down to Covent Garden, and you're into the theater district. And now you're down to Leicester Square. You know, Charing Cross is here and Tottenham Court there. You've made it through Leicester Square. Now you're down to Piccadilly Circus. Now you start down Piccadilly, and it's right here past the Burlington. Here's Albemarle Street, number 21. This is where they live, right here. They live way over here, and they're going to church, and they're walking over here. Now, Lori and I made it in 30 minutes, but I think, now that I think of it, we started down here on the street. We went up there. I don't think we could have made it in 30 minutes going through that warren of streets. Now, I'll show you the next one. Here's a colorful map showing. Now, just look at how much. You take a square mile around where I live in Oak Park, California. Nothing ever happened. Nothing. There's no history. Come with me and I'll walk you through my community. Nothing ever happened there. But here is one little area of London, and here is so let's start with St. Paul's Cathedral. That's been there since 604, not that building. This is the sixth building of St. Paul's, but it's been there since 604. And you start up here. Why is the museum built here? And why is the statue there to John Wesley quoting his conversion experience? Because this was Aldersgate, see? Aldersgate. Here's the beginning of the Methodist movement. Here's Smithfield. You know, here's John Fox's Book of Martyrs, right? All the Protestant martyrs killed by Bloody Mary, 1553 to 58. Fox's Book of Martyrs. It's all about here. John Rogers in this story. Down here is, as you come along... let's see, we're at St. Paul's, and you come along here. Here's Samuel Johnson's house. We're going to tour it next week on a Wednesday. Here's Johnson putting out the English Dictionary in just 9 years. And he publishes it, 2,300 pages, two massive volumes. He translates almost 43,000 words. And like I said, John Milton is buried up here. Shakespeare lived right here at this corner, just by the London Wall, with the at the corner of Silver Street and Monkwell. He's a lodger there for about 8 years. So much history going around, and this is where Faraday is going to church, down a squalid alley. Now, if you were to do a walking tour, you know, from St. Paul's, and you came on up to the museum, and you came back here where Faraday went, and you saw Milton's grave. Up here is Bunhill Fields, the greatest cemetery on planet Earth. And we'll be there next week to sing around the graves of Isaac Watts and all the great songs. John Bunyan is buried there, Pilgrim's Progress. And Charles Wesley and John Wesley's mother, you know, is buried there. And then we go across the street to Wesley's church, and he's buried out behind his church. A lot of history right in this area. Now, Faraday is near death. They come to him and to Sarah. You must be buried in Westminster Abbey with all of the greats. And he said, thank you so much, but that's not me. I've never been in an Anglican church. I certainly wouldn't want to be buried there. And he gracefully refused. Victoria called him to Windsor Castle when he was at his prime and said, this September, at the ceremony this September, I will knight you. And you will be Sir Michael Faraday. And I'm paraphrasing now, but he said, thank you, Your Highness. That is just such a lovely thought, but I can't accept that. That's not who I am. Now, I've never turned down a knighthood. I've never been offered one, but I wouldn't turn it down. But Faraday turns it down. He's offered the presidency of the royal institution. I mean, that's all of his peers. And he turns it down, not once, but twice. They kept coming back. You need to be our president. That's not who I am. They used to call him doctor. People would say, Dr. Faraday, and he would stop them. No, you know, he wasn't even a high school graduate. No, I'm not Dr. Faraday. Even after he got the honorary doctorate from Oxford and the honorary doctorate from Cambridge and the honorary doctorate from Prague, and when he was honored during his lifetime by 95 governments and scientific organizations, still, he didn't want to be called doctor. He was just Michael Faraday, son of a mechanic and a poor country maid who just couldn't believe that God had showed him all of this that he could discover. So, this was the statue that was going in Westminster Abbey, and after he died in 1867, 7 years later, they gave up 9 years later, in 1876, they finally put it in the Royal Institution, where it still is, on Albemarle Street, down on the first floor. He lived up on the third floor. I think it's appropriate there. There's statues all over. Here's the statue over by the Savoy Hotel of Faraday. There's another one on the other side of the Thames River. This is the only image we have of the poor little church Christ, but it looks like that church that we're going to sing in 2 weeks in Edinburgh. You know, look at the overhang up there by the pulpit so that the sounding board would send the sound out. This was the church they built at the end of his life up in the north of England, Bradbury. What's the name of that spot? Barnbury, I think. Barnbury. And so in these days, he would take a cab to church. He was quite old by then. And this is the poem I love so well from Cosmo Monkwell, right after Faraday died. On a portrait of Faraday. Was ever man so simple and so sage? So crowned and yet so careless of a prize? Great Faraday, who made the world so wise and loved the labor better than the wage. And this, you say, is how he looked in age, with that strong brow and these great humble eyes that seemed to look with reverent surprise on all outside himself. Turn over the page, recording angel. It is white as snow. Ah, God. A fitting messenger was he to show thy mysteries to us below. Child as he came, as he returned to thee. Would he could come but once again to show the wonder deep of his simplicity. Queen Victoria offered him a house at the inn when his health was really failing, out at Hampton Court. So I hope to go out there next week. I haven't been to Hampton Court since 1981. And then I didn't know about Faraday. So I want to see where he lived at the end. And this is what they put up in Westminster Abbey after all of his relatives were finally dead. They snuck in a tile. And the tile says, in memory of Michael Faraday, 1791-1867, And I don't know Latin real well, alibi sepulti, but it means he is not here. His body is not here. He's buried elsewhere. But we're remembering him here. Of course, Charles Darwin is buried there right by the pulpit. There's Darwin who wasn't going to go to church anywhere. And here is Faraday who gets a tile, but he didn't want to be remembered there. I wanted to read you this from Faraday at the... We have five sermons from Faraday. Listen to this fragment from 1859. Why is that significant? That's Darwin putting out The Origin of Species, right? So Darwin is putting out the great book in 1859. And they knew each other but weren't friends. But Faraday in 1859 says, "The Christian finds his guide in the Word of God and commits the keeping of his soul into the hands of God. He looks for no assurance beyond what the Word can give him. And if his mind is troubled by the cares and fears which assail him, he can go nowhere but in prayer to the throne of grace and to Scripture." Here's Faraday and Darwin, one publishing The Origin of Species, which was persuading him God is not, even though his wife faithfully went to church every week. And here is Faraday with this great line. So where is he buried? Up at the big cemetery in the top of London, where Karl Marx is buried. Michael Faraday just gives his dates, and Sarah, his wife, and all the plots around him are the members of the church at that Sandemanian Church of Christ. They bought all their plots together, and that's what he wanted, and he's not in Westminster Abbey. When they opened the Faraday Museum in 1972-73, a much younger-looking Queen Elizabeth is there to dedicate this. I want to give you a couple things as I close. If you were to look him up in Wikipedia, it would say a Faraday... He was an English scientist who contributed to the fields of electromagnetism and electrochemistry. It was by his research that the magnetic field around a conductor carrying a direct current that Faraday established the basis for the concept of the electromagnetic field in physics. Faraday also established that magnetism could affect rays of light and that there was an underlying relationship between these two phenomena. Albert Einstein kept three pictures in his office: Michael Faraday, Isaac Newton, and James Clerk Maxwell, the Scottish scientist who followed Faraday and who was also devoutly Christian and built on the foundation that Faraday laid. And the great physicist Ernest Rutherford said, "When we consider the magnitude and the extent of Michael Faraday's discoveries and their influence on the progress of science and industry, there is no honor too great to pay to the memory of Michael Faraday, one of the greatest scientific discoverers of all time." I close with this. There were two boys, Alfred Yarrow, who grew up to become a great marine engineer and a baronet, and Walter Rudd, his buddy. Faraday was their hero. And at the end of his life, when he was taking the horse-drawn carriage all the way from Hampton Court, all the way up to that church in the north of England, they knew the crossroads he would be going by. And they would run to a certain spot. And he's telling it later in life. This is from Alfred Yarrow. "A friend of mine by the name of Walter Rutt and I were so much impressed by Faraday's personality that it was our practice on Sundays to meet Faraday and his wife at a certain corner where he used to go just as before he started up the Caledonian Road, up that hill to the road leading to Barnsbury. And we would stand at that corner and we would take our hats off to Faraday's two teenage boys. We would take our hats off to Faraday, and Faraday, seeing us, would take his hats off to us." And he said Faraday would ride by. And then he said, "And then we ran we would raise our hats and he would salute us by raising his, and then we ran down a side street, and then we ran up one that was parallel to the one taken by Faraday, and we would run and run up to another street which intersected that road, and there we would be standing again when Faraday came to take our hat off to our hero, and once again he would salute them. And then they said, but he didn't know that we kept going and going, and when he got out to church, we snuck in the back. And we listened. We heard Faraday preach. We heard him lead singing. We heard him read scripture. He was our hero. It's a great story. I love that one. So, here's a guy that we don't study a lot in restoration history. And some would say, no, that's not our history. But if I go back there to the beginning, I really think I would stick with the outline that I used for all the times I taught in London. I still think what makes sense to me is to lay it out like this. The old Tottlebank Church, which only has Kirby left. But when I started preaching at Kirby, Tottlebank used to let me use their communion set because Kirby are one cuppers. And my American tourists, I don't know why, but weren't real excited about the one cup. And so this Tottlebank Church would say, Jerry, you can have ours. We'd go up and get the communion set from the Baptist Church so we could use it at the Church Christ where I was preaching. But I had preached at both places. But then next is Glass, Sandeman, and Michael Faraday. And then the Scotch Baptists, the Haldane movement, and then the Campbell movement. Stone had no presence in the UK. But then when you come to North America, the Campbell-Stone movement. Now, we've run out of time, and I'm not going to be able to give that exam that I was promising. We ended up with a full house, and we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, about 20 standing. So we only have about 58 seats here. So we had about 78. Thank you for coming. You're dismissed.